Ferris B'nai Torah presents The Shmooze, an engaging and motivating Mussar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
In Shmooze number 129, Hakar Satov, we mentioned a chazal that I believe you will never hear at a Sheva Brachas. And that is the following Gemara. Rav Avam Nifte mi Rebbe Chiya, when Rav would leave Rebbe Chiya, Amalei, he said, Rachman Letzilcha, Hashem should protect you, mi midi dekasha mi Musa, from something worse than death. When Rav was parting from Rebbe Chiya, he gave him this expression, Hashem should save you from that which is worse than death. The Gemara asks a question, Umi kamidi dekasha Musa, is there something worse than death? The Gemara answers, yes, there is. Umotzani mar mi movis es isha. I find the woman worse than death. Okay, now again, you will not hear this at a Sheva Brachas. It will not be said over at any popular simcha. However, the Gemara has a very specific lesson, and then the Gemara explains to us exactly what it's referring to. The Gemara says as follows, Rav had a wife who was wicked and did everything in her power to make her husband's life miserable. If Rav would say to her, please make lentils, what would she do? She would make barley. If he would say, make barley, she would make lentils. Whatever he asked for, whatever he was interested in, she would do the opposite, willfully, purposely, intentionally. She did everything in her power to make her husband's life miserable. One day, an interesting thing happened, and that is she started doing that which he asked her to do. If he would ask for barley, she would make barley. If he would ask for lentils, she would make lentils. And Rav was amazed by this. He said to his now grown child, Rabbi Chiya, it seems that your mother has improved. She's no longer as rebellious as she once was. At that point, Rabbi Chiya said to his father, I have to admit, it's not that mother has improved, but rather whenever you tell me to ask her to prepare lentils, I switch it around, I tell her barley. If you say barley, I tell her lentils. So she's still the same woman she was, but I reverse it. At that point, Rav said, clever. I wish I had thought of it. What you did was the right thing, but Lamaisa, you shouldn't do it because you shouldn't be involved in Sheker. And that's the end of Rav. Then the Gemara goes on to discuss Rebbe Chiya. Rebbe Chiya had a wife, an equal to Rav's wife. And Rebbe Chiya's wife did everything in her power to make Rebbe Chiya's life miserable and with the same sort of vengeance. Interestingly enough, whenever Rebbe Chiya be walking and he found something that was nice, a beautiful flower, a trinket that he thought his wife would find attractive, Sarele Besudre, he would wrap it up in his sudr, in his handkerchief, Umaisinila, and he would bring it to her. One day Rav saw Rebbe Chiya doing this, and the two of them are in the same sort of boat, excuse my expression. And Rav says to him, Vahakamat Sarele, why are you doing that? She causes you nothing but anguish, nothing but trouble. Why are you doing this? He didn't answer back. Rebbe Chiya didn't answer back, I'm trying to make shalom. I'm trying to win her over. He answered back, it's sufficient for us that they bring up our children and they protect us from sin. Now the Shmooze then dealt with the fact of Hakaras HaTov, despite the fact that she was doing an awful lot of bad, despite the fact that she was wicked, the reality is she did some good. And Rebbe Chiya felt a sense of recognition of that good. He felt a sense of Hakaras HaTov, and that was that Shmooze. What I'd like to focus on this evening is what I consider a rather obvious question. And that is, these two individuals, Rav and Rebbe Chiya, had what we'd call a rather difficult marriage. If you're married to a hag, if you're married to a nag, if you're married to a wicked woman, life is not very sweet. Now, we've always read and we know there's a concept called the tzaddik. The tzaddik is the one who always smiles, always accepts things, b'sever panim yofos, who always takes it with a grain of salt. But the question that I'd like to ask, and I believe it's a rather serious question, is how is it possible, day after day, living with such a woman, day after day, they don't lose their temper, they don't get angry, they don't yell, they don't scream, they don't lose it. How is it humanly possible for a regular individual? And I'm going to grant you for a moment that these were great individuals. I'm going to grant you that they were Tanoim. But at the end of the day, they were made of the same flesh as you and I. They had the same human personalities. They had the same feelings. And when day after day a person shtochs you, digs it in, does everything in their power to hurt you, to make your life miserably, and you know that it's purposefully and willfully done, gets under your skin and it bothers you. How is it shayach that they lived for years in this state, never once getting angry, never once getting ticked off, and Rabbi Chiya would daily look, what could I find for my wife? What could I bring her out of appreciation of what she did? So I'd like to see if we could identify how it is that these people came to this and what was actually the critical ingredient. And to do that, I'd like to take a step into a little different direction. I'm often amazed, and it took me a while to actually define this point, but if you open any popular science article or magazine, you'll probably quickly find an interesting point that doesn't fit. If you open a National Geographic, you'll see a very interesting article about snails, mollusks, or maybe snakes. You'll read about the defense mechanisms of the scorpion, about maybe you'll read about porcupines. And within that article, despite the fact that they'll talk about how intricate the camouflage system is and how intricate the entire defense system is, there's somehow a reference that doesn't seem to fit. And that is a reference to how this evolved. What I mean to say is like this. The porcupine quill is a fascinating phenomenon. The quill is pointed. It has a muscle that's able to eject it. And it shoots it out. It's a fantastic mechanism. The skunk has an amazing ability to ingest the type of plants that it needs. It's able to break down those ingredients into the smelly part. It has a sac to keep it. It has a muscle in its tail to lift up the tail at the right moment. It has a sphincter that's tight. You have a muscle behind it to spray out. It's a very sophisticated mechanism. There are many, many parts to it, but invariably, no matter what you're going to read about, there's some piece about how this evolved. And I was always curious that it oftentimes doesn't seem to fit the discussion at hand. We're discussing the mechanism, we're discussing how it works, and there are many things that you could talk about. You could talk about the biology, you could talk about the chemistry, you could talk about the anatomy of it. Those things aren't discussed because they're not relevant. But how this evolved all of a sudden has to be put into the conversation. Now, the reason why I think is rather obvious, and that is because when you read about any of these facets of Hashem's world, you are amazed by the wisdom, the planning, and the clear indication of a creator. And if you don't answer that question mighty quickly, Rachmana Litzlan, you might become a mamin. You might come to believe in God. So therefore, invariably, there's an understanding that you had better answer that question so that nobody, heaven forfend, makes the mistake of seeing a creator. Nobody makes that foolish error to assume that there's wisdom, forethought, and planning in it, and therefore they answer it. However, if you study the answers, they're typically lame. And oftentimes they're not lame, oftentimes they're humorous. And sometimes I get a kick out of listening to the answers and trying to sort of humorously play along. And let's start with the obvious one that Darwin himself said. Darwin was quoted as saying, "I shudder when I think about the eye." And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to recognize that you have a difficult time explaining how it evolved. You know, there was a freckle on the skin, and that freckle became photosensitive. And then before you know it, it evolved into the cornea and the lens and the retina and the 3 million optic nerves, the 3 million cells that make up the optic nerve. I mean, after a while, you get pretty like almost, come on, are you guys serious? However, I claim any part of the world, the physical world that you study, whether it be elements of biology, chemistry, anatomy, all of it is simple compared to man. And if you'd like to ask an evolutionist the ultimate challenge, it's please explain to me the human. And let me explain to you what I mean by that. To this day, Baskin-Robbins brags about 31 flavors of ice cream. And as you know, those flavors of ice creams come in very different sorts. There's everything from Rocky Road to pink bubblegum to very berry strawberry to pralines and cream, daiquiri ice, jamocha almond fudge. Very different each one with a different sensation, different texture, different aroma, different flavor, because there are 31 different flavors. Okay. Now, as you know, emotions also come in many different flavors. Emotions come in happy, sad, angry, scared, confused. Those are five basic groups of emotions. But each of those groupings have within them many subtitles. Within that category called happy, you could have content, calm, satisfied, excited, thrilled, proud. Proud is very different than content. Calm is very different than excited. They're all within that category called happy, but they're very different one from the other. In sad, you have disappointed, discouraged, lonely, hurt, depressed, despairing. Very, very different one from the other. Angry is not simply the opposite of happy. Angry may be the difference, the opposite of not angry, but within anger you have so many different shades and nuances. Irritated, annoyed, enraged, resentful, upset, bothered, aggravated. You have scared, which is worried, fearful, anxious, panicked, insecure, nervous. The point being, you have a lot more than 31 flavors of emotions. Now here's the question, folks. Where did it come from? Where did happy, content, resentful, worried, fearful, anxious come from? Where did these things called thrilled, lonely, hurt, annoyed, where did they just like happen from? And an interesting point to note is that of all the animals that occupy this planet, only man tears when he's sad. Now, you want to tell me where that evolved from? Well, there were these, you know, women who used to cry, and the men used to really like it when the women cried, so they had many more marriages, many more children, and that's how the species propagated. Tear ducts, upon being sad, flourished in mankind. But if you think about it, the things that we take for granted called emotions are unique phenomena that are inexplicable. Forget defining them. You have to write unique poems to actually describe them, but each is so different, each one is so real, and you have to bend over backwards and do cartwheels to begin to even imagine where it came from. However, that's not the wonder of wonders. There is an ability that almost every human being has to be what we would call telepathic, maybe a Navi, and I'll explain to you what I mean. I can tell what you're feeling. I can read you like a book, and I can tell you whether you're happy or sad, confused, irritated, upset. What is this wondrous capacity that I have, this telepathic ability? It's called your face. You see, your face reads like a book. If you're happy, your face shows it. If you're sad, your face shows it. If you're content, calm, anxious, worried, confused, despairing, depressed, your face shows it exactly. In fact, they'll find little children sometimes can't make that distinction. And I'll have to teach them the difference between someone who's thinking and someone who's angry. Between a person who's pensive and a person who's out to get them. But the reality is that your face, unless you mask it very well, shows exactly what you're thinking, what you're feeling. Now, isn't that amazing? Did you ever try to say, I'm now going to tell the world how I feel? For instance, let's say you try to do it with your arm. Okay? And this is a rule, guys. If I go like this, I'm sad. If I go like this, I'm happy. If I go like this, I'm content. If I go like this, I'm calm. A dog, they talk about a dog, its tail. The tail is down, it's sad. It's happy. If it's upset, it's up. But that's one range, teeny range of emotion. The gamut, well beyond 31 flavors, the human face shows it. You could read it. Instantly recognize it, know it, and understand it. By the way, it's not always that simple. I've mentioned before, Mike May, who was blind from the age of 3 till the age of 40, was a very bold individual, and in college, he decided that he wanted to take up acting. And he went on stage in college, and he auditioned for a part. The part he was given was to be a blind man, which was coincidentally fit what he was. And at some point, the director said to him, okay, you're not acting this well, I want you to act bewildered. And Mike said, how do you do that? And the director said, well, you know, you just have to kind of drop your forehead like this. And Mike said, what do you mean? The director had to go over and shape his forehead and facial muscles in a way that looks bewildered. He had to memorize it because as a child, he never experienced that, didn't recognize it, apparently didn't learn those facial movements. But the reality is not a one of us had to learn how to act sad or happy. It's natural, it's instinctive, it shows exactly what's going on in your emotions. And my friends, I believe that is a phenomenal revelation of Hashem's wisdom, because it shows you something that's beyond any ability of a human to imagine or envision. By the way, you can't even fake it well. If you try to put on an ugly, angry face and you're not angry, most people can read through it. As a matter of fact, in acting today, most people use what's called the method. You see, if I want to show anger, I can't just show anger, because you'll read right through me, you'll see I'm not really angry. The method is where I take an emotion of anger and I learn to have that emotion almost on instinct. I remember one time when I got furious and I learned to bring up that emotion so that in any given context, if the play calls me to be angry, I don't act like I'm angry, I am angry. I remember that anger and then my face reads exactly my emotion. But it's such a delicate thing that you can't fake it. You can't hide it. You can't mask it. It's delicately balanced and it's magnificent. That is one unique phenomenon of emotion. There is another unique phenomenon of emotion, and that is that they come and they go. In 1963, there was what was known, Newsweek reported, what they called the Career Girl Murderer. The Career Girl Murderer was a fellow who was a crack, I guess then he was a coke addict, and he had been arrested on 100 different occasions of break-ins, and he had served time, had been released from jail, and supposedly this was his last break-in, he was going clean. And in this break-in, he found one girl inside the apartment, he tied her up, took the money, was about to leave, when her roommate came in. Her roommate came in, he quickly tied her up, and for some reason, her roommate lost it. And she starts saying, "You won't get away with this, I'm going to remember your face, I'm going to call the cops." He describes these, he says as follows, "I went bananas, my head exploded." You see, in his mind, this was his last crime. In his mind, he was going to be done with this. And now she was saying the worst thing. He absolutely lost it. He began clubbing them to death with a soda bottle. And it was a brutal, gory murder. But for the rest of his life, he looked back on that event and couldn't understand it. He looked back and said, "What came over me? How could I have done it? What was wrong with me?" But you see, any emotion that you have, whether it's anger, whether it's joy, whether it's loneliness, whether it's depression, whether it's contentment, any emotion comes and goes. But here's the difficult thing about being a human. When I'm feeling really, really down, it colors my entire world. We discussed in the anger shmooze the fact that when I get angry, it's not just that I have an emotion called anger, my glasses begin to change tint. They become pink, then they become a little bit burgundy. Before you know it, it's red. Before you know it, it's scarlet red. And the world that I see is now tinted. I now view things differently. I look at you differently. I feel differently. And the assumption on an emotional level is that this is reality. And one of the great keys to success in life is recognizing that this emotion, as powerfully as I feel it, is here now, but will pass. Right now I feel lonely and depressed. The world is bleak and dark. Tomorrow morning I'll get up and I'll feel differently. Right now I'm on top of the world and I feel like I can conquer every mountain. Right now that's good, but that doesn't mean this will last forever. Every emotion comes and leaves, waxes and wanes. One more step and we can begin tying things together. I had the opportunity to be a father for now quite a number of years. And throughout almost 20 years now, Sunday has been Abba's day. Sunday afternoon particularly, I take the kids out. That's a time when I spend taking the kids to different places. And I really enjoy taking the kids wherever I can to different things. Invariably, at some point, the kids say something like, "Abba, can we get ice cream?" So when my two oldest were little people, and I would take them out, I'd gladly take them for ice cream. It cost me a buck and a half. I was a big knocker. You want two scoops of three? You want Sunday? It was great. No problem. Not long ago, I came to a very interesting realization. You take six kids to an ice cream store and they start ordering sundaes, you're going to spend a lot of money. When the bill hits $25, $30, you say, wait a minute, this wasn't quite what I had in mind. And I've had this conversation numerous times with my children when they say, Abba, can we get ice cream? I say, okay, guys, listen, here's the deal. We have a choice. We can go to the ice cream store and you guys can get a sundae or a cone, or I'll buy 2 gallons of ice cream, cans and cans of whipped cream, sundae fudge. We'll have it tonight after supper. We'll have it Tuesday night as well, Thursday night as well, as much as you guys want. What's your choice? Keeping in mind, I'm going to save money if I do 2 gallons in the supermarket and then buy it in an ice cream store. Here's how it works. The 20-year-old says, good deal. 17-year-old says, absolutely. 15-year-old says, I don't know. 11-year-old says, I'm not sure. 7-year-old says, mm-mm. 5-year-old says, no way! Absolutely not. No, 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 no. You promised. It's not fair. Abba, you promised. You promised. You promised. And you could watch it go down the line by age, and it's really one simple issue. When you're immature, right now is life. Now is when I want it. Now is when I have to have it. Tomorrow may never come. Tuesday night could be weeks and weeks away. And if you talk to me on Thursday, it's a different decade because I live in the immediate now. The hallmark of the immature mind is the immediacy of the moment, the reality of the moment, and the inability to see even a step beyond. The hallmark of chachma, the hallmark of wisdom, the Gemara in Talmud says to us, what is the measure of wisdom? Haroa es hanolad, one who can see the future, but not clairvoyantly, not binivua, but seeing the future because you live in a very different reality. Seeing the future because I go forward and I see what this brings, I think things out, and I live in a very, very different perspective. Being able to look deeply, deeply far into the future is a hallmark of wisdom. And now I'd like to share with you something that I find rather profound. We discussed previously the Chinuch's pshat in revenge. The Chinuch says that you should not take revenge because revenge is a lack of bitachon. If I know that Hashem runs every aspect of this world, Hashem brought this person here, for me to take revenge is a lack of trusting in Hashem. And if you look in the Rambam has a very different version of why the Torah says lo sikum. The Rambam says it has nothing to do with bitachon. It has to do with a wholly different concept. It says the Rambam, because Eitzel HaMevinim, the Mevinim understand, HaKol Hevel Havoy, everything that happens is silly, frivolous, Ve'eno Kedai Linkom Aleim, it's not worthy of taking the Kama. He slapped me, he touched me, he pinched me, so what? It's Kleinikite. The Kleyoker gives a mushal. I'll modernize the mushal a bit. Imagine you have a prince. When the prince is involved in building his Lego palace, and he's building and building for days, intricate turrets, intricate pathways, or the moat, it's beautiful. A whole binion. One of the palace guards sees it and says, hey, kid, knocks it over. Just destroys it. And the prince comes running to his father, the king. Kill him! Kill him! Take off his head! You know what he did? He destroyed my whole work! Just kill him! And the king looks at his son and goes, you're right. He was a creep. He shouldn't have done it. But I'm not going to kill him for it. The toy. You're a child. Your vision is very, very short-sighted. In your world, it's a big, big deal. But the reality is, a year from now, you won't remember it. 10 years from now, you won't even think about it. If I'm going to kill him, that's forever. The punishment doesn't fit the crime. If you ask people after a major fight, ask them 2 weeks after the major fight, tell me, sir, what was the issue? I don't know. Ask people after they got into a major, major machlokas, what is the point that you fought about? Invariably the answer is, I don't remember. And if you think about it, almost all of the issues that we get into fights about, whether it be anger, yelling, screaming, ranting, whatever the level, invariably it's about petty little things. Kleinigkeit. And if you're not quite sure I'm right, try this one. When you're really enraged, when someone has really done something inappropriate, try it on a jury of your peers. Tell a number of your friends what the great avla that someone did to you. And you'll find yourself sounding just like a three-year-old. He pinched me, he pushed me. I mean, he pushed me because I pushed him yesterday. He pushed me because he pushed... What? Listen to your kids. There's a 73-step involvement. She pushed me, he pushed me, he pulled my chair, he put the frog under it. But it's a sequence of pettiness. But if you study the human condition, the reality is that almost all of it is pettiness. When we get angry, when we get upset, it's almost always petty. And my friends, I believe it really stems from one simple thing. That one simple thing is the vision of man. I discovered something as a bachur. I had a tremendous bracha. When I was 19 years old, I turned short-sighted. I had perfect vision as a kid growing up, never needed glasses. When I was 19, all of a sudden my eyes went and I couldn't see beyond 18 inches, 2 feet, blind as a bat beyond that. And it was a huge bracha. Because typically, as a bacher, going in the streets of New York City, especially in the summer, is a major challenge. Me, no problem. Take off the glasses, a machaya. What, Nisyonis? What are you talking about? There's nothing beyond 18 inches in front of my nose. I ain't got no problem. And I discovered that it was a huge bracha, this thing called being myopic, being able to only see right here. And in that context, it is a bracha. However, the reality is that most human beings are extremely short-sighted. We see what's here, we see what's now, I feel an emotion, and I feel so angry, so upset, such a need for vengeance. Why? Because what he did was so grave and so serious. But if I take a step back, if I view this 2 weeks after the event, 2 months after the event, I don't even remember the grave avla. But the problem is I'm living in the here and now, I'm living right here, and right now, I can't get beyond this. Wisdom is something that comes with age. Wisdom is something that comes with learning. The two gentlemen that the Gemara is discussing were Rav and Rabbi Chiya. Tremendous gaonim. People of vision, people of wisdom, people who had a very, very broad view of life. Their wives were hags, their wives were nags, their wives were obnoxious. But you know how they were able to live with it? So she said this, she did. I asked for barley, she made lentils. I asked for lentils, she made barley. In the scheme of things, does it matter? Does it bother me? You see, I believe that even people as great as Rabbi Chiya and Rav, had you gotten into their skin day after day, day after day, they would have lost it. But the trick was, there was nothing that got under their skin because they had a brilliant, far-reaching vision and were able to see things for what they were. A little, tiny, insignificant thing. She said this, she did that. Does it matter? What am I, a child? I'm going to go bent out of shape. I'm going to go lose it because it's kleinekind. It's silly. And the reality is that that vision allowed them to be who they are. Now, with that in mind, I'd like to share with you something very, very telling. There's a gentleman who stood in front of the judge this week. The next 20 years of his life were being decided. You see, he was up on charges of embezzlement. And what's unusual about the case is that he was an Orthodox Jew. And what's more interesting about the fact was that he was doing pretty well. As a partner in his law firm, he was making $1 million a year. Now, some of us can manage to get by on $1 million a year. I mean, you know, a little tight, but, you know, we can manage to sort of eke it out, right? Okay. Now, here's the point. What really happened was that he was accused of padding his expenses. But I don't mean his expense account, like when he'd go to dinner, charge extra things on pad. He would basically, instead of charging the client 30 hours, he would add a few hours, 32 hours, 35 hours. He would add hours, and the sum total of the amount that he was accused of stealing was $300,000. Now, this made me wonder. I said, now, wait a minute. If, let's say, you're making $35,000, and you can't put your kids in school, and you can't even dream about a house, and you have the opportunity to lie, steal, and make $300,000, listen, I recognize an assayin. But the man is making $1 million a year. What does the extra $300,000 mean? It's not going to change his lifestyle. It's not going to radically make him a different person. And I'm hard-pressed to believe that he really desperately needed the cash. And I'd like to share with you what I believe the motive was. The motive was quite simple. I won't get caught. But here's the irony of it. Sir, you're a very intelligent person. And I've spoken to the man quite a number of times, and I know he's a very intelligent person. Did you do the following, the risk versus reward ratio? Let's assume it's only a 5% chance that you're going to get caught. Make it a 2% chance. Is it worth it? Do you think it's worth spending 20 years in prison for the extra $300,000, 30% of what you're making now? He would, of course, say, of course not. So why'd you do it? Because it'll never happen. You see, right now is this opportunity to make more money, and the future isn't going to be. It won't ever happen. And if you think that's remarkably short-sighted, if you think that's ridiculous and no intelligent person could really believe that there's no chance of getting caught, there's no possibility, that's us every day of the week and twice on Sunday. We live in an extraordinarily short-sighted here and now. Living in the moment, being here, this is real. 2 weeks from now is not real. 2 months from now is far, far off. And a year from now is, I can't even imagine it, I can't envision it. And the reason for that is because we are B'nai Olam Hazeh. We are Olam Hazeh Jews. We are built into this world, living in this world. And because of that, we cannot get beyond our myopic vision. Every once in a while, you hear about personalities who lived in a different dimension. When you read about Reb Chiya and a Rav, you see people who walked the planet but were miles and miles above it. They're B'nai Olam Haba. They lived in the world to come. What that means is they understood one clear fact. Hashem created me. I have a few short years, and this world really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if I live in a fancy home or a plain home. It doesn't matter if I wear beautiful clothing or regular clothing. The whole thing, the whole life setting is silly, frivolous, and irrelevant. But you have to be a giant of the spirit. You have to be a man who has a true vision of life to view things that way. If you do, one of the results are you don't lose it. Because you recognize that that which people do is petty and silly and doesn't really matter and doesn't touch you and doesn't change your life. In Muncie, I got a couple of guys who are electricians. And they happen to work on the crew that do the custom homes. And they work in these brand new, spanking gorgeous, 20,000 square foot homes. 20,000 square feet. Let's say you got five kids. That's 4,000 square feet. I mean, if your kids are wild, they're really terrorists, how big does the mansion have to be? However, again, the interesting thing is that when you talk to these people, you hear that the people who are building these homes take every decision so seriously. The wiring, three switches or two, where to place the sockets, where to place the lighting, because it matters so much. And you know why? Because they have every intention of living in that house forever, at least 100 years. However, you probably recognize that if you're buying that kind of home, you got to be at least 45, 50 years of age. And the odds of you living 100 years in that home are pretty slim. As a matter of fact, 20 to 30, if you're lucky. But when they build the home, it's forever. Every particle of this house has to be gorgeous. You know why? This is my home. This is my eternal home. And that reality is something that I think that you find over and over, that people live in such a temporary vision of life. This temporary moment is so real. If you'd like to understand why emotions change a person, that emotion flares up and it feels like it's going to be forever. My immature personality reinforces that. So right now you've done the worst thing in the world to me. You stepped on my toe. You all take vengeance. The Rambam is saying, grow up. Take a broader vision and understand that the emotion comes and goes. Understand that your vision has to be much broader. Put it into perspective. However, doing this is quite difficult. How does one get a broader perspective on life? How does one view the future? And I'd like to share with you what I consider a great technique for doing that. And that is to study life. You see, people make the mistake. They assume their Avodas Hashem is in the Beis Medrash. Learning and davening is where they grow, and the rest of life is whatever. I claim that if you study life, you can do a tremendous amount of growth. But you have to know what subjects to study. The first subject in life to study is history. But not ancient history, not history of the Palestinian people. Study the history of my life. Write your biography, study your life, study the events in your life, and come to some core cognitions. I was once bar mitzvah. And it may have been a while ago, but I could still see myself vividly there. And if you're younger, view yourself at 8 years of age. And that same I was there, and I'm here now. Isn't it interesting? I too will be 40 and 50 and 60, mitzvah Hashem, 80. I, the same me. And then study some of those strange things that you've done when you lost it, when you were joyful, when you were happy, and study the intricacies of your life and ask yourself, why did I succeed? Why did I fail? What happened? By the way, Richard Nixon got caught. The entire Watergate scandal only happened because of one thing, because Richard Milhouse Nixon knew his importance. And every detail of his presidency was recorded. He would sit there at night with a microphone in the old reel-to-reel tape days, and then he taped over every event that happened because he recognized history was in the making. And I'd like to share with you that the Chazal's perspective on your life is that you are as important as Richard Milhouse Nixon. You are living history. You are living and creating your eternity. And one of the great exercises that I highly recommend is writing a biography. Your biography. Writing a biography of your life, your ups, your downs, what happened. Because when you do that, you become a student of your life. You become a student of you. You begin recognizing what makes you tick. You begin recognizing your victories and your failures. And you may say to me, hey, Rabbi, that's great if my name is Winston Churchill, Richard Milhouse Nixon, but I'm just a regular guy. I'm not doing that. But if you understood from Chazal's perspective, you would do just that. If you'll tell me that this is too much, I can't do that. I'll share with you one other thing to study. And that's become an anthropologist. Become an anthropologist means study the human. If you're not important enough to study, study other people. Study the human condition. Watch when people do things and learn the following understanding. The human being is the strangest occupant of the planet. The human being does things that so amazes me. The human being does things that are almost comical. And then do the next step, which nobody does. And that is say these words, and I too am a human being. You see, we're all very skilled at noticing how other people do things that are foolish. How other people wreck their life. Look at that governor. Can you believe it? He wrecked his life for what? What an idiot. What a fool. Can you believe there are people like that on the planet? I could believe there are people like that on the planet. And I too am a people. Oh. And when you watch people do foolish things, and when you watch them get carried away with the moment, when you watch them put such importance to such frivolous, silly things, say to yourself, that's a person. And I too am a person. That is human nature, and I too am a human. And if you train yourself to do that, you learn great, great lessons in life. You begin to recognize who you are. I believe there's a tremendous lesson to learn from Rav and Rebbe Chia, and that is the greatness of a human, how a human being can supersede, get so above this world that nothing touches them. Their wife could chepper and bother day after day. It doesn't matter. It's kleinigkeit. It's small. But why doesn't it get under their skin? Because they recognize it for what it is, for what it is, which is nothing. The reality is that when you discuss a tzaddik, half of it is working on the midos. Half of it is working on the anger and not taking vengeance and working on the humility. But there's another half to the tzaddik. That is that world perspective, that broad perspective, being able to put things in their right place and understanding that things really don't matter. What he did to me, what he said to me, what she said, it really doesn't matter. But to understand that, you have to understand you. You have to understand that there are 31 flavors in Baskin-Robbins, but there are far more flavors of my emotions. And I have very different variations and shades and nuances, and they're always functioning within me. Learning to recognize them, learning to see their effect, learning to see how they color my vision and the way I view things allows me to understand why I act the way I act. But once you understand that and you learn the great lessons of emotions that they come and they go, then it's time to learn the second lesson, which is to be bigger. to learn that not to sweat the little stuff, not to get all bent out of shape about the little kleinigkeit that people do, because that's all it is. 2 weeks from now, I won't remember it. 2 years from now, it won't matter at all. And everything that we get all so angry, so upset about, really is of very, very little value. Like the Lego blocks with the prince. Tati, kill him, because look what he did to me. What we get upset about, what we get angry about, typically is that. I'd like to close with one last step. And that is a question that the Meiri asks on this Gemara. You see, the Meiri asks that what Rav said to his son Rabbi Chiya, his son Chiya, doesn't make much sense. Why? Because Rav came to his son and said, look, your mother apparently has improved. Because now when I ask her for barley, she brings barley. When I ask her for lentils, she brings lentils. To which Chiya, his son, says back, no. It's not that mommy improved, but rather I reverse it. What does Rav say back to his son? Clever, good chap, I wish I had thought of it, but don't do it because it's lying and you shouldn't teach yourself to lie. The Meir asks, why not? This is mipnei shalom. This is a classic situation where you're supposed to lie. To make shalom bias, you're supposed to tell a bald-faced lie. Hashem himself, Kav Yochel, said a sheker, if it could be, with Avram Avinu, when Sarah said Avram is old, and if it could be, Hashem changed the expression to bring shalom bias. So Meiri says, why should Rav say to his son, he shouldn't lie, quite the opposite, he should. Says Meiri as follows, when are you supposed to lie for shalom? When there's going to be a churba, when there's going to be destruction. But Rav was saying to his son, she's not changing and I'm not changing. She's not changing because she is who she is. I'm not changing because I'm not makbid. And now, my friends, I want you to hear these words. Here's a man who's saying testimony about himself that she cannot get me angry. It's not even a chance, not even 1 in 100, not 1 in 1,000. It doesn't matter day after day after day. It could be for years and years. She is incapable of getting me angry. Don't change the words because it won't lead to any consequence. There's no point in lying here because there's no increase in shalom. It can't possibly increase it. And when you hear these words, you see a different world. You see a man who's living so above the fray, so above Olam Hazeh, that he has a confidence to say, I'm not makbid, and he will not lose it ever. That is a man who walks the planet as you and I, but is on a totally different plane. He's in control of his emotions, and totally has mastered his midos, but more than that, has gone above in terms of his perspective. He views everything for what it is. Nothing bothers him, and ultimately that is the secret to gavas, the secret to being gullah. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us the wisdom, the ability to put it into practice.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Teferis B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all the Shmoozing free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax deductible and count as miser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.